Well, greetings all. I've gone back to look at the teachings, such as they are, of one of our greatest grandfathers, Bodhidharma. There's a lot of talk about Bodhidharma and little stories about Buddha Bodhidharma, how he bested Emperor Wu and how he sat for 9 years in a cave. And he has a long history in Zen because he brought Zen sitting to China and introduced not new Buddhism, because Buddhism had been there for centuries already, but the practice of the experience of Buddhism rather than the formalities and all the forms and the studies that the Chinese knew so well. It took him a long time to really introduce it. And when he did introduce it, he introduced it in a very, very simple way. And we don't know whether he really existed or whether there were a lot of people called Bodhidharma who were originally coming from India and bringing this new way. But it's now boiled down to, we call it Bodhidharma and think of him as a real person who gave these teachings. Red Pine has translated what he could find. And the first couple of translations are considered to be authentically somebody actually who went to the particular little village in China and began not only sitting but some kind of martial arts that still exists in that town. A bunch of monks still live there and still practice martial arts to this day. So he also is said to introduce tea to China. took his eyebrows off, and the eyebrows became, or eyelids became tea. So when you see pictures of Bodhidharma, it's just round eyes with nothing to open and close, because he was just looking at the wall all the time. He didn't need them. I mean, it's a little bizarre, but that's what all these stories are. However, what his teaching was Buddhism 101 in the way that we understand it. And it's a very beautiful teaching and very short. It's called Outline of Practice. And he offers two roads to the path. One is by reason, instruction, and the other is by practice. Sitting, he calls it. Sitting is unspoken, complete agreement with reason. So it's not that we have to give up our thinking mind, which is sometimes what we end up imagining because of the way the teaching comes to us. We don't throw away our intellect at all. In fact, we're meant to be using it really, really well, with extreme discernment, to really look carefully and clearly and allow ourselves to see even the things that we don't want to see. So, to enter by practice, he offers four inclusive practices. One, the first one, is suffering injustice. This is a really interesting and sometimes painful subject. He says, embrace adversity and understand the causes and conditions that go into it. So that understanding is using reasoning, and the embracing is much deeper than that. He goes into past lives. He says, I can just understand that whatever I did in the past brought this up. I wouldn't say that anymore, because I think there were so many other conditions that went into what I did that I can't think that I did it all by myself. There are too many causes and conditions, so many different forces that go into every single little life. But I can accept whatever comes without complaint. And that's what he advises. Without complaint. And look at how it makes sense. Sometimes it makes sense in the smallest way, in the most intimate way. And sometimes it doesn't make sense until we have a whole hawk's eye view of the huge picture of it and how the adversity fits into a very much bigger picture. Where is it coming from? What is it? Because we don't know what to do unless we truly understand it. It's not that we suffer it. And suffer means to allow it. It doesn't mean to feel the pain of it, though we do feel the pain of it. Suffer just means allow it. Like Jesus said, suffer the little children to come to me. That used to bother me so much as a child. I think, oh, that's terrible. But it doesn't mean that. It just means allow. And allowing is a very cogent, important word in our practice. How do we allow things and not be overwhelmed by them or let what's really wrong continue in a bad way? It's our challenge. And he says, if we are able to accept things without complaint, that this puts us in harmony with reason. That then we can be reasonable about what the situation is, rather than resisting it and trying to push it away or beat it up or do something to it. That just creating the situation in our mind as clearly as we can, then we're able, in this harmony, to begin to think about it clearly and maybe find some way to act. I think these days everyone is so speeded up that we act so often without much thought, that we have to. We're always under duress. We're always being forced to go, go, go. And quick, 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 let's get it over with and let's get this done. And doing that, we're not really engaged with it deeply enough to see what's needed. So I think this is really important teaching just for ordinary everyday life. Accept it without complaint. Because a complaint is immediately my idea. I don't like it. I want it to go away. And once the I stands up like that, everything gets all mixed up. The second one is connected. It's adapting to conditions. He says, conditions rule us. We don't rule conditions. Conditions rule us, and everything we experience depends on them. Success and failure depend on conditions. He says, the mind itself neither waxes nor wanes. In other words, the mind isn't the conditions. It's the conditions is our life, really, and we are our life. But the mind itself doesn't create the conditions. We're given our life, we're given our name, we're given our inheritance of every different kind. We are the conditions. That's another thing to accept and realize that we depend on these conditions. And the more we can reason about it and understand it clearly, the more harmonious our life can be also. Even though, you know, everybody goes through horrendous conditions. We're seeing this these days, so many terrible stories that people are telling, so many different versions of suffering. But it really is what we get. And there are practices of not only accepting, but actually feeling gratitude for our conditions. David Stendel Rost has a whole practice about that that's very helpful, of realizing how generous life is to us in all the different ways, and actually identifying the ways in which we receive generosity over and over every single day. We usually often easily overlook it because it's so easily taken for granted until the battery goes dead on the car, and then all of a sudden we think, oh, thank you, car, I'm so glad when you can run. Is he there? I hope so. The third one he called seeking nothing. He said deluded people are always longing for something. The wise wake up and choose reason over custom, over habit. So that's the other side. These are two sides that he keeps balancing about reason and, I would say, compassion, or relationship, or connection. Let the bodies change with seasons, he says. Let everything change. He says, all phenomena are empty. There's nothing worth wanting. That's for us. That's an amazing thing to say. With Amazon right around the corner, right in our, how can we say there's nothing worth wanting? But if you think about it in terms of your own life and death, it's true. It's completely true. He says, to have a body is to suffer. You can't get away from it. From the minute you are delivered, the delivery itself is your first suffering. And it's really hard on the baby. It's really, really hard. As hard on the baby as it is on the mom. And that's just the beginning of our suffering. So when we sit here and it hurts, that's a piece of cake compared to the rest of it. But even so, the more we sit, the more we realize how much we suffer, physically and mentally both, because we can't run away from it anymore. So then what do we do? But he says to seek, to look for a way out, is to create more suffering. And that's what Buddha taught too. That was the third noble truth. You do have suffering and it works this way, and if you try to get out of it, you make it more. That takes some deep thought, really. It isn't an automatic kind of expression of us. We're animals, and our first way of being is the animal way. And this extra thinking that we can do with this piece of us comes after the animal thought. And so it takes an extra step, I think, and I think that's why not in the general way of humanity, not an awful lot of people come this way, because it's a little bit harder to make that extra step. And I think our practice is about encouraging people, nudging people to take that step, to show how it feels and how it tastes in the body, how it feels to practice. To seek is to suffer. To seek nothing is bliss. So that's why that Korean practice of not knowing when we sit is so helpful. Just if your mind is going around and around with all the stories, just remember that you don't really know anything. It's just your mind going around and around. It's not knowing. And then it's a whole lot easier just to breathe and be. And be the ignoramus that we are. You know, in sitting, we can be an ignoramus. It doesn't matter what we are. In fact, we aren't anything. We're just being there. We don't have to perform. We don't have to present ourselves. We don't have to be somebody particular at all. In fact, our particularity is very much in question. It's one thing one day, one minute, one hour, and another thing another minute, another hour. We just keep putting on different hats all the time. The last one is practicing the Dharma. The truth that all natures are pure. That's what the Dharma is. Practicing the truth that all natures are pure. Even Donald Trump. Even so. That all appearances are empty. As Shakespeare says, it's just an empty play. It's the whole thing at play. And sometimes you get so attached to the way it should be going, and it's not going that way, that it becomes terribly important and wildly interesting. But actually, we don't know how it's supposed to be. We only know when it's over. And then we look back and say, oh, we can put our finger on it there. Oh, we can name it. But our eagerness to name things, to name what's happening before we actually understand it, is a mistake, because it creates more misunderstanding. Better to agree that we don't know until it becomes very, very clear what's actually happening. So he says, no being, no self, which is just the sense of allowing everything to be as it is and go with it. He says, they give their body, life, and property in charity, since there's nothing worth begrudging. It's an interesting word. It's nothing worth begrudging. No being, no self. So we give our body, life, and property in charity, since there's nothing worth begrudging. And we teach others without attachment and practice the six virtues to eliminate delusions, by which is practicing nothing at all. The six virtues are the paramitas, giving virtue, energy,
Patience,
meditation, and wisdom. Thank you, John. So that's the whole kit and caboodle of the two roads to be the path. Reason and practice as suffering and justice, adapting to conditions, seeking nothing, and practicing the truth that all natures are pure and that all appearances are empty. I think all our lives give us reason to understand those things. Places where we resist and the places where we suffer and the places where we find harmony and ease and the places where we can just give over. So that's what I brought today. There's time for questions, comments.
Thank you. I just have a question about the story, our understanding of Bodhidharma, where he learned all of this. Because I know, like, Dogen, he went to China and then brought it to Japan. Did Bodhidharma go to India?
He grew up in Sri Lanka.
Oh, okay.
His teacher was Prajna Paramita, who is in our lineage. So if you know the lineage chart, Prajna Paramita, and they say now that that's probably was a woman. So, and Buddha's Dharma came from northern India, Bodh Gaya, and a piece of the tree came down to Sri Lanka and is still there. Or akin of it, anyway. And so the Dharma came with it very, very early on, right after Buddha died. So then Bodhidharma took a very dangerous and long, long trip. It said that it took months and months to get to China, all along the South Asian borders. And then when he got there, he met the emperor, who asked him who he was, and he said he didn't know. So, that was a beautiful start to the whole thing. And then when he left, the emperor asked somebody, who was he really? And the guy said, that was Avalokiteshvara, didn't you know? Mm-hmm. And Emperor Wu said, I missed him. How could I have missed Avalokiteshvara? And then the other famous story is his sitting in the cave waiting for somebody to get the picture. And finally somebody came up and desperately wanted to learn what he was doing and stood out in the snow with his request, and Bodhidharma just sat there and wouldn't respond for a long time. And finally, this horrible story, now they say, oh, this isn't true, but who knows, he cut off his arm to show his sincerity and offered his arm. See, Bodhidharma, I really, really mean it. Please, let me sit with you. Probably not. But that's another one of those old crunchy Zen stories.
So if they talk about Wei Nang as the sixth patriarch,
mm-hmm.
does it mean he is the sixth one after Bodhidharma?
After Bodhidharma.
Oh, got it.
Yes.
So they live pretty close together.
Well, some hundreds of years.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Because they're, each one is a generation, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a ways.
Right.
I'm very bad about numbers, so I don't know exactly, but he came long after, but was very much affected by the Lankavatara Sutra, which is said to have been brought by Bodhidharma, and that teaching, which is about the teaching of sitting.
And the emphasis on sitting in Buddha's own teachings, is that as strongly present?
He's always sitting. Wherever you read about him, he comes and sits down with people.
Right.
So, I think so, yeah. And when people go, when his disciples go out into the world, they go out with a particular affect that people notice, because that comes with the sitting.
Was it Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu they get into that tiff about, do I have any merit created by all these stupas and temples I built?
Yes, that was the beginning of the interview with Emperor Wu, who was very proud of building many temples and supporting many, many monks. He was a really good Buddhist and spent a lot of money on it. And he asked what merit he would have gotten from that. And Bodhidharma said, no merit, which was a horrifying idea. Yeah. What? I don't get any points for this. I'm not going to go to heaven. Because the whole idea of merit, of course, is a kind of a Buddhist or a Hindu Buddhist idea anyway, that you do good deeds and you build up this quality that stands you in good stead in however you need it. You become a better and better person. But in Tibetan practice, they also understand it this way, but at the end of everything they do, they dedicate the merit to the benefit of everybody. They give it all away. So if we believed in merit, we would have to do that too. Just give it away.
Isn't that what we do at the service?
Yes, we do, actually. Yes. Yeah.
So how does that work out with karma? You have negative karma, positive karma, creating negative deeds, and you get some negative karma and the positive. What is your feeling on that?
Well, my sense of karma is not about that at all. Karma just means action, acts. So from the moment point of view, it's whatever we do has an effect in the future. It's going to affect everything out to the edges of the universe, you know, physically speaking, perhaps. And as you think about all the things that go into making one person, from the grandfather of the grandfather of the grandmother of the grandfather of the, you know, going all the way back to Adam and Eve, and then going back to the creatures in the sea, and then going back to the first little spark in the ocean that created life at all, all of that is in us. All of that is our karma. All of that affects how we are and where we are right now today. So we really can't say this was bad and this was good, and because of that, this turns out this way. You can't say. It's awesome, really. It's a beautiful view because it's so big. And it's so impersonal. It's not about us. We have all the good and all the bad in us that you can ever imagine. We do. We have all of it. It's what we do with it that makes a difference. Yeah, and that takes discernment and reason in order to overcome some of the really untoward things that we might do otherwise. Yeah. And sometimes we do them anyway. The animal rule sometimes. Anything else?
Well, on that note, I think it's kind of in modern Western culture, there is this thing where people very easily say, after something happens, oh, everything happens for a reason.
Yes. Yes, right.
And I always feel a bit skeptical about that.
That's an easy out.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course it's true, but it's a very superficial truth.
Right.
Yeah.
The other saying is, it is what it is.
Oh, that's the other one, right. It is what it is. Okay, but how about right now? Yeah. We, in a way, those are fleeing. We flee from the situation with a little comment like that. We just go right away instead of staying there and actually looking clearly at it. Yeah, it's easy. well, it's about time to sit. So we can walk first, right?
Yes.
Walk for 10 minutes.
It's a little early, but that's okay.
Hmm?
It's a little early, but that's okay.
That's okay.
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Beings are numberless.
I vow to save them.
Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.